Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. With more than a third of Americans classified as obese, behavioral scientists are experimenting with ways to nudge shoppers away from the chip and dip aisle and into the produce section. Not with finger-wagging lectures or taxes on junk food, just a few visual prods to stir shoppers from shopping on autopilot. And so far, researchers are finding noticeable increases in sales of fruits and vegetables. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter for the New York Times and winner of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. He wrote about these supermarket experiments led primarily by a pair of academics at University of New Mexico, Las Cruces. Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So among the experiments, social scientists are trying to change social habits, placing mirrors inside of shopping carts. What's the idea, and is it working?
Well, the idea is to find ways to counteract and or compete with the sort of amazing array of marketing schemes that the food giants use the second you walk into the grocery store. You know, they are all about getting you to make spontaneous decisions to buy their stuff, which generally is heavily loaded with salt, sugar, and fat. And so these particular scientists are looking for ways in the field called sort of behavioral economics. To nudge people into helping them make healthier decisions in order to resist some of the many, many lures to the junkier stuff in the grocery store.
I can just imagine myself shopping, which often is done rather mindlessly, looking down at my shopping cart and seeing, oh, there I am. It's kind of, I don't know, for a lot of people, it must be sort of plummeting their self-esteem at the beginning of the shopping trip.
I think there are kind of two modes you're in when you're shopping. Either you're like really hungry, which recent studies have shown sort of drives you to buy less healthy food, or you're so busy that you're not paying attention, you're distracted, as you said, sort of mindless. And getting beyond kind of these two modes is kind of what is at issue here. One of the things that happens in the grocery store is that, you know, they typically are designed to be kind of these la-la lands of fantasy where you lose your self-consciousness, and that enables the grocers and the food manufacturers to guide you toward their products. So one of the main aims of these researchers is to try to reinstill the id, some self-awareness of yourself, to remind you of who you are, where you've come from, and what might be some of your own kind of personal health challenges.
So what have been the results of placing mirrors inside of carts?
So far, the mirror is still highly experimental. They're still dabbling with it. When I was with them in the store in El Paso, one of the shoppers said, hey, guys, you know, what you really need to do is tilt the mirror vertically so you show everybody's belly. And they're working in El Paso because the obesity rates there are just, like, phenomenally high. One thing they have used, though, in stores in several parts of the country to huge success are just these little signs placed in the shopping cart that simply tell people what the average consumer shopper in those stores are buying in terms of vegetables and fruits, and specifically which vegetables and fruits. Again, so here they're aiming at conveying information about social norms, which again is something that you lose walking into the store. You're totally driven by what the industry, food industry, tells you is good and normal and you should be buying. But this is more of an attempt to sort of reinstall some notion that, hey, there are some other norms going on here. On average, people are buying so many fruits and vegetables, and people want to, by and large, fall into that general norm.
This is just in the experimental stage, and the tests, I guess the testing population isn't that big. But any results yet from the mirrors or the green arrows or these, what they do is, I guess, they divide shopping carts. You put fruit and vegetables on one side and other food on the other?
Yeah, no, absolutely. In some of the experiments, the shoppers actually doubled their purchase of fruits and vegetables. In other cases, as much as 10 or 15%, et cetera. But actually, the results are really phenomenal. What's intriguing is that it's actually moving beyond the experimental stage, because the grocery chain based in Texas that has allowed these researchers to do their work is so delighted with that. They're now going to equip thousands and thousands of their grocery carts with these signs, and they're eyeing the mirrors as a next step.
Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, most contemporary American supermarkets have acres of fattening food, this high sugar, fat, salt, that must make up a great deal of their income. So why would they want shoppers to spend less in those aisles?
Well, it turns out, this was a total surprise to me, it turns out that the lowly produce section of the grocery store is actually one of the highest profit centers in the store. Their markup on fruits and vegetables is higher than almost anything else in the store besides meat. So if apples go up and Twinkies go down, they're perfectly happy with that, because their net profit is going to gain.
Michael Moss, this kind of behavior modification is very different than other proposed fixes. I'm thinking of, Bloomberg's ban on huge sodas, or some people have proposed taxing trans fats, posting calorie counts. So what's the thinking behind this more subtle and I guess self-guided methodology?
The thinking is that the way out of this obesity, diabetes epidemic we're in is not to look to Washington for policies or for taxes or any imposition on taxpayers or the consumer, but rather to sort of find ways to let economics drive the solution. That's what I loved about this experiment. The two researchers themselves are Republican-leaning social scientists. The grocery store itself, while it's caring about the health of its consumers, is profit-motivated. And this could totally work on its own without any government intervention needed.
Michael Moss, investigative reporter for The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Nice talking to you.
You'll find a link to read his article about how social scientists are trying to nudge shoppers to buy less junk food and more produce. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, let us know, what would steer you off your habitual supermarket strategy? Don't forget, you can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle. Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them Silent Breed is people! We've gotta stop them.
In the 1973 classic sci-fi film Soylent Green, Charlton Heston's character is desperately trying to warn others that the processed food rations he and his fellow humans are eating is in fact made of people. The film envisions a dystopian future where much of the population survives on a green wafer purported to contain high-energy plankton. Now there's a new Soylent on the market, which claims to provide the body with all necessary nutrients. The creator of Soylent sees it not only as a more efficient way to produce and prepare food, but to potentially solve the world's hunger problems. Lee Hutchinson is senior reviews editor at Ars Technica. He lived on Soylent for a full week and blogged about the experience. Lee, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having.
So a little bit on the origins. Who came up with Soylent?
Soylent is the product of an engineer named Rob Reinhardt. He got the idea after being frustrated with the amount of time that it takes to prep and cook food and how much it was taking out of his day. And so he put forth the idea of doing sort of this engineering type approach to food. They had a crowdfunding campaign that was very, very successful. They blew through their funding goal by like a factor of 10, I think, and they'll be shipping here before the end of the year.
So he named the product Soylent. Kind of some bad associations there.
Yeah, I was talking with Rob Reinhardt yesterday, spent about an hour on the phone with him, and I mentioned that. And he said that the name actually was chosen to be intentionally provocative. It's funny, too, right? There's an element of humor to it because, Soylent Green is people. But the name is also intentionally provocative to pique curiosity. Reinhardt explained it like people tend to rush to judgment on food products, especially something that's purporting to be as revolutionary as Soylent is purporting to be. And so calling it Soylent invites people to sort of linger over it and dive in a little more rather than just dismissing it.
It's not made up of people and it's not green, but it has been called a beige cocktail. Now, that doesn't sound very attractive to me. What's in this?
So it's got a list of some very sciencey sounding ingredients. There's maltodextrin, there's oat powder, rice powder, pea protein. There's a little separate vial of grapeseed oil to provide some triglycerides and fat. I actually have the entire ingredient list. It's very sciencey sounding.
How did you make it? Is it something you put in a shake?
So I used a blender, but you don't have to use a blender. In fact, the way they prefer you to make it is with a like a shaker bottle with like one of those little round metal spheres inside of it that agitates. It tastes like it's really odd, right? So it's nondescript, and you notice how it feels in your mouth more than you notice the taste. They version it like software, right? So I received Soylent version beta 0.89, just like a software or like an application. It's got a lot of grit to it right now, which they're trying to work through. The grit is due to the rice powder they put in it. The particle size is really high. So it's very like chalky, like makes the inside of your mouth feel like the bed of a river with a lot of silt over it.
Mmm, yummy.
Yeah.
Well, how is it different than something like Carnation Instant Breakfast or other liquid nutrition quick fix meals?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one that I got fielded to me a lot. So when I asked Rob about that, his take on it was that there's kind of two areas that meal replacement products fall into. There's the consumer stuff, and then there's the medical stuff. And for the consumer stuff, you're talking about stuff like Carnation Instant Breakfast or Slim Fast, those kinds of things. Soylent is attempting to differentiate itself from those by having a lot less sugars and stuff. The consumer side stuff has lots of fructose and simple sugars, stuff that runs through you very, very quickly, and stuff you really wouldn't want to put into your body for three meals a day. On the medical side, there's lots of products. There's stuff called Jevity. I know Nestle has an entire line of meal replacement stuff that's used for like tube feeding and liquid nutrition in hospitals. From a consumer standpoint, that's just too expensive. You can't really go out and buy those kind of things yourself. The differentiation is that Soylent is nutritionally complete, they say. It doesn't have the tremendous amount of simple sugars that the consumer stuff has. And the cost is relatively low. Once they start shipping product, the goal is to bring the cost down to about $5 per person per day, which still leaves room for them to be profitable and at the same time lowers the bar for access for people to buy it.
Any particular side effects? I mean, you mentioned SlimFast. Do you lose weight on something like this?
Over the 5 days that I was on this stuff, I lost 2.2 pounds, which is probably not statistically significant. It was only for 5 days. The creator has said, Rob Reinhart has said that he's lost a fair amount of weight being on it for months and months at a time. As far as side effects go, let's see how to be polite about this. I was a little gassy. let's just leave it at that. I was a little gassy, and my wife was a saint for putting up with me.
So I'm kind of imagining, if you said $5 a day, that this might be something, Soylent might be used for emergency situations or maybe refugee situations or something. But as someone who lived on it for a week, is it a realistic way to combat world hunger?
Potentially. The biggest drawback to sending Soylent to an underdeveloped area, just for example, is that the product requires clean water to make. So you get your Soylent, it comes in a bag, and it's a dry mix. And you have to mix it with about 2 liters of water per day of Soylent. Now, there are ways to work around that. I brought this up to Reinhard, and he said that they're looking at potentially, once they get to that stage where they're distributing Soylent and working with GMOs and governments to send Soylent out to underdeveloped areas, they're working at ways of attaching sort of water purification devices with the bags of Soylent. There's already a product, though, that the UN distributes, Plumpy Nut. It's actually like a peanut-based paste. The primary difference between Soylent and something like Plumpy Nut is that the Plumpy Nut product has to be licensed and produced. It's not something that any company can make. It is a licensing process you have to go through before you can be a supplier for it. And it's not always the most easy thing to get. At least that's my impression from talking to Reinhard and looking up, you know, the Wikipedia article on it. Something like Soylent, the intent is to have it be an open, finger quotes, free type of product. The components will be widely available. The recipe to make Soylent will be something you can simply look up. If you want to make your own Soylent, you don't have to pay the Soylent company to make it. You can just go buy the ingredients yourself.
I'm just thinking of the response that people have had to lab-based food. Reinhardt has got a Kickstarter campaign that's going like gangbusters. What do you see as his chances for success with Soylent?
Well, I think there's a stigma that gets attached to the word processed where it's applied to food. Processed food isn't necessarily bad, just as finger quotes organically grown food or unprocessed raw food isn't necessarily by default good. Food processing can do many things. It can be abused horribly, and I think in a lot of cases, of course, it is. But at the same time, food processing isn't necessarily bad. And so a product like Soylent that's made up of entirely processed ingredients gets, I think, stigmatized unnecessarily. Each one of the ingredients that's in this thing has been run through tremendous amount of FDA testing. It's not like this is stuff that the Soylent guys are making up in their kitchen, you know, brewing in their backyard like Walter White making meth or something. You know, this is a product made up of tested ingredients. As far as success goes, they're doing very, very well. There was an article on Vice where the Vice guys wrote up Soylent and profiled Rob Reinhardt, and they at least seemed convinced that he's going to end up coming out of this a billionaire and will make tremendous amounts of money and be very, very successful.
Lee Hutchinson, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Lee is senior reviews editor at Ars Technica, and you can find a link to read his Soylent blog and more at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a documentary on aging disguised as an international sports drama. We're going to follow a group of super competitive ping pong players, all of them in the 85 up age range, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Banish the bridge game and shove off the shuffleboard. Competitive table tennis for seniors is the subject of the new film Ping Pong. The film follows seven competitors in the over 80 division of the World Veterans Table Tennis Championships in China's Inner Mongolia. That's where 100-year-old Austrian player Dot DeLow told a reporter that you are never too old to go for the gold.
Why are you participating in this competition?
Ah.
You are so old.
I'm not that old.
The film shows the arch rivalries and the individual motivations of the traditional sports drama, ramped up by the presence of cancer and dementia and the physical deterioration at the end of life. The film's producer is Anson Hartford, and he joins us now from the BBC in London. Anson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, ping pong does have this tension, these personalities, this will to win that we've seen in many sports dramas. Is that what drew you in as filmmakers?
Absolutely. It actually all started a few years ago with just a picture. It was a picture in a magazine. It was of Dorothy DeLow, the Australian you just heard. She was 97 then, and it was just this image of somebody in their later years wearing a national strip. She was representing Australia, and somebody representing their country at that age just sparked a lot of interest. So we looked into it and quickly discovered this world of veteran sports and veteran athletics. And it was a surprise to us, and very quickly understood that this was a rarefied world. The final age group in the Veterans Ping Pong Championships is 85 plus, and the people who make it to these competitions are pretty unique for various reasons, and their stories are pretty extraordinary.
There's something entirely different at stake here. I mean, we've all heard these stories of athletes with injuries like the torn meniscus or the sprain, but here we have the 81-year-old Terry Donlan. He's got a collapsed lung. He's got cancer. He was actually given just 1 week to live and 5 months later was there playing in China. Let's hear him talking about that road.
When you have the prostate cancer, they say, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. He said, you can't have sex. I said, I've had my share. I'm all right. Anyway, I proved them wrong again. Yeah, I've proved them wrong. It's nice. I think your mind can cure a lot of your body.
It is hard to witness Terry. He's gasping for breath during a match. We also see Ursula Biel, a one-time female world champ in the over 85 set, a woman who another competitor says pretty archly, you know, she can hardly stand up. And I was watching this and thinking, you know, it's hard for me not to sound patronizing when I say, oh, they're just so old and dear. But there is something so inspiring about their will to win. And I wonder what you saw, you know, as filmmakers confronting your own ideas about aging and what the aged do.
I mean, for us, actually, Terry's clip there was is really sums up the film in a lot of ways. All of the characters, all of the players that we met, they had a common bond, which was their attitude to life, their attitude to ping pong, and the fact that they don't want to sit down and just give up and die, and Terry puts it that way. They still have this desire to engage with the world, and for them it's ping pong, but it can be anything. And in a sense, it sort of pushed away our preconceptions. I mean, we had to sort of level the playing field ourselves. You know, we had moments filming Les, for example, when we'd film some landscape and we'd turn around, we're on an athletics pitch and we turn around and Les is attempting to do a headstand and he's 89. and you have that thing of wanting to say, oh no, Les, this is a bad idea. But at the same time, this is why Les is who he is. Mm-hmm. And actually, for him to harm himself doing what he loves doing is what he would prefer to have happen.
Tell us a little bit more about Les Darcy. He's Terry's doubles partner, for one. Mm-hmm. But you speak with his son and his daughter, and they tell you a little bit about what made the man that is Les.
Les is, he's really a sports fanatic. I guess his life has been defined by sports. He was a PE teacher. Earlier on, when he was growing up, he was actually quite poorly, and his way out of ill health as a young child was to body train, to weight train. And he kept that up to when we were filming with him. He was training with the British champions who were training for the 2012 Olympics. You know, he was giving them tips because he'd been through it, and he was inspiring the Olympic hopefuls. He also discovered athletics can be played at an older age, and so went to the States to enter in a world athletics champion, veterans athletics championships. And he went in the shot put and the javelin and the high jump.
Wow.
And then whilst he was there, he realised that the long jump, I think, wasn't being attended by anybody in the over 85s class. So he decided to do it and obviously set the world record.
Well, here's Les. He plays really with singular focus in the championship, but gets slightly off the beam when he loses his bat. There was a bit of intrigue there. You know, everyone was assuming it was stolen. But here he is talking about the kind of enforced humility, I guess, of aging.
It's these later decades that can be most punishing to one's ego. You find that the things that you could do with alarming alacrity, you can't do it all.
And that's a clip from the film Ping Pong, which follows a group of competitive men and women in their 80s and 90s on the road to the World Championships of Table Tennis in China. I'm speaking with Anson Hartford. He's the producer of the film. Watching Les talk about and confront physical decline, this really is the last chance for many of them. Now, did you talk with any of them about what that meant, their end of life?
Sure. I think mortality was a theme throughout the film, and we talked, I think, in depth with all of our characters. We wanted to confront this. Making the film was almost wanted to be a window into this world of veteran sports, but window into our senior years. Myself and Hugh are in our 30s. We wanted to know how to navigate this as we get old, and these people would be great teachers. Through doing this, the film actually became about what it is to be alive and what life is about, rather than what death is.
Well, let's hear some of that a subtext of mortality making its way forward. Ursula, at one point, tells her son, I would like to die at the table tennis table, but not too soon. And we also heard from Inga Herrmann, 89 years old, who has dementia. Now, here she is speaking to you in German about her idea of death. Well, what is she saying, Anton?
Inga Herrmann, she suffered a stroke and was she committed herself to this dementia ward. In the basement of the hospital, she found a ping pong table, and extraordinarily she found a coach and started to play. And over a course of some years, she developed a lot of her skills back and essentially became an outpatient and is now a volunteer manager of the ward that she committed herself to. So part of her job is to fit out the ward with paintings and pictures, and here she is talking about a picture that she saw in a church which describes perhaps light at the end of a tunnel.
Dass man vom Dunkeln ins Helle kommt. Dass man beim Tod nicht in das Dunkel geht, sondern in das Helle geht.
Interestingly, she puts it that it's a comforting thought for old people to feel that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
She is just seems so lovely to me and looks so happy playing, more so than the Austrian via Texas Lisa Modlick, who I have to admit I was not cheering for. And I wonder about you. You know, you must follow these seven very, very closely. Were there other contenders? How did you choose these seven?
It was very hard. The championships are set in Inner Mongolia, and we travelled there with about 12 players. And when we were there, we discovered another perhaps 12. So we filmed in total 24, and it was a combination of how they did in the competition in the tournament. We needed people to make it through to the semis and the finals. And it was about who they were and what their story was about. For us, meeting Lisa was a marvellous moment. She is a fierce competitor. And really sort of ballsy. She brought a kind of glamour to the sport, which we were also looking for, because for us it's sort of, there's an obsession to stay young, I think, and so we were looking for somebody to speak a little bit about that, and her competitiveness was wonderful. It was a joy to film, and in a sense she was just most vocal. They were all there to win. Les would, 7 years ago, he would do a headstand on the table tennis table before the match, because he reckoned it would give him 5 points head start on the opponent, because they'd be like, oh my God, who's this guy? And so Lisa did the same thing. You know, she would do a bit of trash talking before the game. She would throw in a few comments that to unsettle her opponent, and she was very good.
In school, I always had to be number one. I like it.
Could you describe your style of playing?
As irregular as my driving. I try to make people walk a little. Not too hard, because I'm an old lady, but it's not how hard you play, it's where you put it.
At the World Championships, we see that there are a lot of other matches that are taking place side by side. Now, you were there, you and your brother, focusing on these much older players in these older age groups. But does the crowd pay much attention to this over 80 set?
It was really interesting. It was a 6,000-seater arena, and there were between 20 or 40 tables, depending on which part of the competition you were at. And so the noise was massive with the ping-pong balls. But the attendance was incredible. Ping-pong is a revered sport in China. It was televised every night. Not only were the sort of the 40-year-olds being given the prime spot on TV, but they would also then jump to the 85, the last category, 85+. And that took us by surprise, but we very quickly realised that there is a reverence also in Chinese culture for the elderly and sageness and wiseness. And so there was a lot of focus actually on that group. And the audience absolutely responded to their games as much as the professional, I guess, younger groups.
How about you, Anson? Have you and your brother started playing ping pong to fend off old age?
Well, we are brothers, so we're competitive. We used to play when we were younger quite a lot. And during the making of this film, we obviously picked up the paddle again, and we played all of the competitors, and I have to say we were beaten by all of them.
I could not have played against them.
But we learnt a lot. We learnt that in old age, you develop and hone the art of deception. And their ability to spin the ball was pretty remarkable.
Anson Hartford, producer of the film Ping Pong, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now you'll find links to watch a trailer and to find local listings at wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around. There's more Word of Mouth coming up after the break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're listening to a violin concerto by the minimalist composer Philip Glass, widely acknowledged as one of the late 20th century's most influential music makers. He's worked with artists, musicians, and filmmakers from David Bowie to Woody Allen, and famously collaborated with the theater director Robert Wilson on the landmark opera Einstein on the Beach in 1976. Even after Einstein, Glass did not quit his day job as a New York cabbie and sometime plumber. In fact, he was once called to install a dishwasher at the Soho loft of a very shocked Robert Hughes, who was then Time magazine's art critic. Clay Wirestone is arts editor for the Concord Monitor and a contributor to Mental Floss, where we found a list of 11 celebrated artists who did not quit their day job. Great to have you back, Clay.
It's good to be back, Virginia.
So the trajectory is usually you work at some kind of menial job until you hit it big, then you quit, and then you're a full-blown artist. Why do you think these artists did not?
Well, I think that's the stereotype. But I think being an artist, either a writer or a visual artist or a composer, they're not all known for necessarily being the most lucrative professions. And a lot of people simply want to have lives, you know, they want to have homes and spouses and not have to scrape by month to month. So I think there's a real attraction to that steady gig, whatever it is.
What do we know about Philip Glass? He wasn't just a plumber, but a cabbie. How long did he do it? And do you have any idea why he chose?
Well, for Philip Glass, I think it was really a matter of survival. I mean, he was working in New York City in the 1960s and 1970s, and he was working in a field where it was a very much an underground emerging field. And for someone like him, who came from a working class background, I believe his dad ran a music store, he did whatever it took to make ends meet. And for him, that meant working as a plumber, that meant driving a cab. He actually kept his cabbie's license and was driving the cab into his 40s. It was only at the age of 42 that he decided not to renew the cabbie's license. He thought, well, maybe this music thing is making me enough money now to support me.
And over across the pond, T.S. Eliot, most well known for his modernist masterpiece, The Wasteland. Writing was not the only thing that occupied his time. What was Eliot's other job?
Well, he actually had a couple. During the writing of The Wasteland for about 8 years from the 1917 to 1925, he worked for the bank, Lloyd's of London. He worked in their foreign accounts business. He was very well liked. People thought he did a great job. But his friends, led by the fellow poet Ezra Pound, were really kind of aghast that he was punching the clock like this. They actually put together a collection and raised money to give him the equivalent of his bank salary for some 5 years if he would just quit the darn bank job and go into writing and criticism full time. And Eliot actually turned them down because, as he saw it, why would he just take 5 years of security when he had potentially a career's worth of security in the lucrative banking sector? And even after he did leave the bank in 1925, it was only to go to another full-time job, which was at the prestigious publisher Faber & Faber, where he was an editor and actually then worked 9-to-5 for another 40 years.
Well, it's a wonder that when maintaining full-time jobs, so many of these people can actually produce anything. In fact, you write about Toni Morrison, who had a strategy. She just got up really early in the morning.
Exactly. Well, Toni Morrison, like Eliot in his later career, Toni Morrison was an editor, and she worked for Random House for some 20 years and was also a single mom with two kids. For the first part of her writing career, at least, she had to get up before 5 every morning because she said that's when her kids got up. And actually, this is also interesting. After she finally left her job at Random House, she said it took her a couple of years to figure out just how to be not so busy all the time, to actually find the space to be calm and to write and without having this constant job, constant work kind of deadlines around her.
Yeah, that's what we imagine, that you have to have some calm, some place of quiet. But I think of the poets Wallace Stevens. He was an insurance man in Hartford, Connecticut.
Exactly.
And William Carlos Williams, who remained in his practice as a pediatrician. Now, did either of them ever talk about why they stayed in their day jobs?
Well, I think for Wallace Stevens, it was actually mainly money. I mean, I think insurance is one of the more lucrative fields that people could be in, and he actually is working for what people know as the Hartford now. It's a still continuing, surviving insurance company. He also was a very ordered, Wallace Stevens was a very ordered and very routine-oriented guy. He didn't have a car. He would walk to work every morning and actually compose poetry in his head When he got to his office, it was about a 2-mile walk, he would then make sure that he got it all down, and then he'd go about his work. For someone like William Carlos Williams, who I think is in many ways one of the greatest examples of this, he found direct inspiration in his life for his work. He was very interested in capturing kind of colloquial speech, how real people talked. And as a pediatrician for some 40 years in New Jersey, he really talked about that as being one of his sources of inspiration. He heard people at their high points, at their low points, and he heard how people actually spoke. He also used those experiences as a doctor in writing prose. He published a book that was called The Doctor Stories, you know, a collection of kind of vignettes based on his experiences.
Any other artists that you can think of that actually found inspiration from their workaday jobs?
In the case of Bram Stoker, who's really well known for writing, of course, the horror masterpiece Dracula, he had written before, but he was kind of a theater critic, and he came to the attention of Sir Henry Irving, who was an English actor of the era. Irving hired Stoker to be his personal manager and to look after a theater of his called the Lyceum in the West End of London. But for Stoker, kind of coming into that creative milieu of being around all of these famous and kind of outrageous personalities, it led him to write and publish his first horror story and to then start kind of a trajectory of works and publishing that led to Dracula in 1897 when that book came out. And it was a huge hit, and he actually still kept working for Irving for another 7 years until his benefactor died.
You also tell the story of the sculptor Richard Serra. Now, this is a sculptor who does these massive, like the size of ship's hulls, almost like often round concentric sculptures. He actually founded a company employing a number of his New York City artist friends. In fact, he was a contemporary of Philip Glass at that point. What were they doing?
Well, the company was called Low Rate Movers. They basically had a single van, and the way that Serra put it was the various people that he worked with, they would share the van, and each would only have to work 2 or 3 days a week. But what's great is that the people that he brought in to Low Rate Movers were Chuck Close, the painter, Spalding Gray, who became known as a monologist and actor, and Philip Glass, who apparently just really liked to work. And yeah, and he just said it was really the ideal situation because they were able to collaborate and then also find the time to go off and do their creative projects, you know, on their own terms.
Well, this one really threw me. Kurt Vonnegut also worked as a car dealer. I mean, some of the other jobs I see is a little more sort of creative. I suppose car dealership is creative.
I think Kurt Vonnegut actually wanted to be someone like Wallace Stevens or somebody who would make a lot of money and then be able to write on the side, because Vonnegut had already been known at this point as a science fiction writer. He'd published stories, science fiction stories. He'd published his first novel. But he really thought that, well, maybe I can find some sort of regular gig that will bring in a little more cash. So he started a car dealer in 1957 called Saab Cape Cod, which was just complicated by the fact that the Saabs of the era were really terrible, terrible cars. He wrote a really funny little essay about it in 2004, just talking about the fact that Saabs of the era, you essentially had to put in oil each time that you refilled the car, something he said that, quote, something that most straight women were unwilling to do. And actually ended up closing the dealership kind of within the year. He then suggested that it was his bad experience with Saab that was the reason that the Swedes had never awarded him a Nobel Prize for literature.
Clay Wirestone, arts editor for the Concord Monitor, also a contributor to Mental Floss. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
There's a link to Clay's full list of celebrated artists who did not quit their day jobs at wordofmouthradio.org. Gary Burton was 13 when he heard his first jazz record. By then, he'd been playing the marimba for 7 years and had toured around his home state of Indiana and as far as Miami with his siblings. The Burton family band came apart shortly after Gary heard this. Benny Goodman's band doing After You've Gone. That song helped launch a career that has spanned the globe, the decades, collaborations with musicians from Chick Corea to Stan Getz to Astor Piazzolla, and originated what's called the Burton Grip, playing the vibraphone holding 2 mallets in each hand. Today, Gary is a 7-time Grammy Award winner. He's 70, the former executive vice president at Berklee College of Music, and he spent the majority of his life playing and teaching jazz. He's now out with a new album called Guided Tour, a new autobiography called called Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. And he joins us now from his home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Happy to talk to you.
Do you remember what you thought when you first heard that record, that Benny Goodman track?
Yeah, and just hearing a little of it now really took me back. What I always remembered was just the kind of excitement that it offered. I'd never heard anything like that before. And I thought, wow, this is such a great beat, and it's got a great feeling. I want to find out what this music is all about. And from then on, I was hooked.
Now, before hearing that record, you were growing up in a small town, Indiana, not a place I imagine a lot of marimba or vibraphone players. How did you pick up the instrument?
The truth is, I didn't pick it. My parents did. They wanted all three of the kids in the family to have music lessons, and my older sister had already started on piano. And when I was about six, they decided it was time for me to have an instrument. And they looked around, and there happened to be a lady in the area who played marimba and vibraphone and gave lessons. So that's how I came to get started. They took me over to meet her, and she became my teacher for the first for a couple of years, more or less. And then we moved to the other end of the state of Indiana, and that was the end of the lessons. And I discovered then that instead of my instrument being, you know, universally recognized and available, that in fact it was a very rare instrument, and you know, most people didn't even know what it meant when you say, I play the vibraphone.
Well, let's listen to where you've gotten to since. This is a track called Jane Fonda Called Again. It's off of the Gary Burton Quartet's new album, Guided Tour. Jane Fonda Called Again off the new Gary Burton Quartet's new album, Guided Tour. Does Jane Fonda often call?
No. And I, of course, don't know her at all. It just seemed like a funny phrase. I saw it in a magazine, and I often get ideas for song titles from ad copy and, you know, lines that you'll see in magazine stories and so on. And somewhere in some magazine, I was reading like a People magazine that's full of great title possibilities. And there was Jane Fonda Called Again. And I said, that's a great song title. You've got to find the right song for it. And that was the one.
Gary, you're known for what is called the Burton grip. In fact, it's playing with two mallets at the same time on the vibraphone. How did you develop the technique?
I grew up in a small farm town and I played alone most of the time. And it sounded very incomplete. I wanted some harmony and more chords and sounds to fill out the music somewhat. So I started, you know, playing with four and gradually got more dexterity with it. And at a certain point decided that the more traditional way of holding the mallets was kind of awkward. And I experimented and found what, for me and for many other players nowadays, it's turned out, is a more comfortable and convenient way of holding them. And even though I didn't name it the Burton grip, it became eventually known as my grip. And it's the most widely used technique for manipulating four mallets these days. And I'm sure the thing I'll be most remembered for over the passage of many years will not be that great solo I played on that record or whatever. It will be, oh yeah, that's the guy that played with four sticks. So that's my fate, I think.
I want to hear a little bit more about your incubation from this Indiana farm boy to moving very young to Nashville and working with A-list session and lead players like Boots Randolph and Chet Atkins and this guy, Hank Garland. Let's hear a little bit from his record, Jazz Winds from a New Direction. This is the song called Move. Thank you. Gary Burton playing there on the track called Move from Hank Garland's record Jazz Winds from a New Direction. Gary, how old were you when you played that song?
I was 17.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm just wondering how, you know, jazz and country is not a union we hear an awful lot about.
Very true. Well, I grew up, you know, not far from Nashville in southern Indiana. It was about a 3-hour car ride to get to Nashville. And it was actually Boots Randolph, who you mentioned, who kind of put me in touch with the guys in Nashville. He had started getting known as a session player himself in Nashville. Even though it was a country music town, they were starting to add saxophone in backgrounds on Elvis Presley records and that sort of thing. And he noticed one of the main guitar players in town was talking about wanting to make a jazz record. And that was Hank Garland, who was the number one country session player. But he had become a big fan of jazz and really had learned to be a pretty advanced soloist in the jazz field. And he convinced his record company to let him make a jazz record for a change, and was looking for vibes. And there were none in Nashville. But Boots Randolph said, well, you know, there's this kid up in Indiana you might want to hear. So he drove me down to Nashville the next time he had a session going on. And I met Hank, and we played a couple of songs together. And then Hank proposed that I come and spend the summer. I was just graduating from high school with plans to go to college in Boston in the fall. But I had the summer open. And he said, well, come down, and we'll play in a local club on weekends, and we'll make this record. And that's how it all started. We not only did all that, but at the end of the summer, I had become friends with Chet Atkins, who at the time was, of course, a major recording artist himself, but also was the head of RCA's division in Nashville. So he proposed to the company that they offer me a record contract. And by the end of the summer, and when I was on my way to Boston to school, I already had my own record contract, and which was just seemed like a fantasy.
Well, let's hear about some of those collaborations. This is one of your pioneering works of jazz rock. This is your first as a band leader, and the record is called Duster. The track is General Mojo's Well-Laid Plan. This is a few years before the album that's considered to be a landmark in jazz rock, Miles Davis's Bitches Brew. Did you know what you were embarking on at this time?
Well, I did and I didn't. I didn't know if it would necessarily become a genre in its own right. I just knew it was something that I wanted to try musically. And I was being pretty calculating about it. And I realized that most of the people I played for were twice my age. I was in my early 20s in those years, and the audiences were in their 40s and older. And just doing the math, you realize that, well, by the time I'm 40, they'll be 80, and they won't be coming to jazz clubs much to see me. So I wanted to connect with my own age group if I could. And I also asked myself, what do I like? What do I listen to? And I was at the time really enthralled with the new rock that had arrived, the Beatles and Bob Dylan. Rock used to be pretty boring for musicians. And, you know, we make fun of all the tunes that only had three chords and to them and so on. But here came rock musicians that were playing much more sophisticated music with, you know, adding things like string quartets and Indian sitars and different things. So I was very interested in this, and it just seemed like the ideal, you know, choice for me. I wanted to do something different, something youthful, and there it was just sort of staring me in the face. By 1970, the genre had changed its name to jazz fusion and was often rolling, particularly after Miles joined. At the first, we were considered heretics because rock was the enemy. stealing audience from the jazz musicians. And people would even say to me, why are you doing this? It's wrong. That's the last thing jazz people should be doing, is using rock elements. But I was drawn to it, and the audiences liked it as well, I discovered. So once that happens, you're encouraged to keep on.
And now you're the 70-year-old, right?
Right.
Gary Burton, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Gary's new album is called Guided Tour of his autobiography, Learning to Listen. You can find more on both and also on his upcoming date in New Hampshire. Gary's going to be playing with his band on September 15th at Plymouth State University. For details, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some of your listening time with us today. If you like what you heard, you can pass it along. You can post segments on Facebook or Twitter, or email them to friends. The links are easy to find on our Facebook page or at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Thank you.